So last time we had two lectures where we have talked about the constructs that you might have seen already in your introductory programming courses, like the typical locks. And this time we're going to see a further concept which has not made it yet into the mainstream languages on a kind of standardized base, but there's things on their way to incorporate kind of the next level of parallel programming with atomic sequences of instructions. And yeah, let's dive right into that. So two of the recurring properties of the means that we had so far for somehow achieving synchronization between several parallelly running threads were quite general properties, in the sense of that they you're going to see them also in other areas of programming languages. And these are the concepts of, for once, abstraction, where you would want to offer only the a very rough and generalized interface to a data structure, such that the user of such a thing doesn't need to know about the internals of how that thing actually works. So that is one of the aspects that we're interested in. The other one is the composability in that case, so that if you use these abstracted objects, you might want to recombine them to something new. So yeah, you want to do that without any interference between those things. So these are two fundamental concepts which we like to have in high-level languages. They somehow intersect in certain areas, especially when you have abstracted a lot away and still want to compose and somehow have to make sure that the internal wiring of these things actually fit together. How might that be a problem in our case? Well, let's consider an example where we have something similar to our tutorial, where we have a common data structure. In our case, let's have a linked list data structure where we already offer some, a kind of an abstracted interface, where we offer a method for inserting things to the end of our list with a push, and also we might offer something like a for all to somehow access everything that's stored inside of that list. And the setting would be one that uses the concept of composition, where you would reuse your linked list such a way that it can be composed within a set implementation. And for that, you would, for example, like to reuse some of the interfaces of the linked list, for example, the push. You might be tempted to offer the push to the external user. And if you then continue on and would like to have something like an insert operation that actually keeps to the interface of such a set, you would like to, for example, first of all, execute a for all to check whether the element already exists, and then use the push in case it does not exist at all. So that is also something that needs to be atomic in order for nobody to interfere between the for all and the push, such that you can be sure that the insert doesn't create any duplicates. So the problem is then that if you want to do that in a kind of a thread-safe way, you run into certain problems where you where the concept of safe access to your data structure somehow now depends on how the internal wiring of your internally composed linked list actually works. Because, well, although you could, for example, wrap your insert method with a lock data structure such that something like the for all and the push is actually accessible only in a mutual exclusive way, then you still make sure that the other interface method that you have exposed to the outside don't interfere with your access at the moment, because if you expose them, for example, you still need to somehow make sure that they don't interfere in the short amount of time between the for all and the push, for example, which was what you originally put the locks out there. So, yeah, they somehow need to use the same mutex, which would then need to, yeah, you would need to either access the internal wiring of your linked list, or well, create another lock that you would put all your exposed methods within, and thus have something like a two-folded lock, which is which is then maybe correct, but interferes with your performance because you create a large number of locks instead. And yeah, you see, it's a bit tricky, and it's not it comes not naturally that if you try to compose components that are for themselves thread safe to use, that the result that you get from composing them together is once again thread safe, you might run into new problems with that and have to actually do a little bit in order to get that to work in a thread safe way once again. So the solution with the plain lock data structures, although it is already on a quite high level, still might not be the solution that you're actually up for if you want to use that in an intuitive way without running into your original thread safety problems. So the idea that you already have seen on the slides for the last few lectures was originally that you would want to mark certain areas of your code as areas which you want to work in an atomic way, in the sense of that they should work as a transaction. We have already tried to introduce that in a kind of similar way. In detail, what we did was we introduced this block structure, well, maybe more like this. So you have a block for marking the sequence of instructions that you want to have as a transaction, and use a keyword in order to announce that that should be an atomically executed area. And with that, you get certain already the idea of what that is about. You could even more think of ways to make that more composable and quite abstract, in the sense that you would also introduce retry as a means of aborting our current try to get the whole thing in a transactional way, and restart from the beginning. As well as you would, for example, allow things like a nested atomic block to be integrated into our own atomic block, which would, well, in most cases, then not add anything to the expressivity. Well, it's just, since the surrounding block is already considered atomic, then the nested one doesn't add anything more to the thing. So you can compose that without having to think more about that. So that would be the kind of the grand vision of what you would like to achieve for a programming language. And yeah, so that is the description if you didn't pay attention. It's for you to read at home. Yeah. So, the only thing that I haven't mentioned now is probably this one here. Of course, just claiming that such a thing is transactional is one side, but what would happen if we actually have a conflict, and we might, of course, run into conflicts with that, and then you need to think about what happens if such a conflict actually happens, and in such a case, well, we would assume that the things that we have done in there would then just be rolled back to the initial state and tried once again. So the whole thing would be restarted and undone before, if that's somehow possible. So what is such a conflict that I'm talking about? Let's first of all make sure that we talk about the same thing here. So let's define what we assume a conflict to be, actually. So a conflict occurs when we access the same piece of data. Then we talk about the detection of a conflict when the transactional memory system, which sits on my machine, actually observes that such a conflict has occurred. And then we have the term of resolving such a concept, and that is when the transactional memory actually does something about it by, well, whatever means it has, by delaying or aborting or whatever suits you. So you can imagine with that general definition of that, there's, many ways to implement transactional memories. There are certain criteria that you can come up with what transactional memory actually is like. So if you design such a transactional memory implementation, you have several degrees of freedom, for example, in terms of concurrency control. So for that, you can have either optimistic or pessimistic versions of that. What does that mean? Well, we have the pessimistic version here, which would act in a way that the system is always expecting that a conflict may occur, and it tries to somehow check whether the next instruction would lead to such a conflict, and in that has certain benefits. You might then start to act and kind of prevent what you do by delaying one of the transactions, or delaying would probably be the solution of choice here, and you could try to implement something like that based on locks, which would then once again open the whole chapter of deadlock problems. So but that's one way of doing it. Then there's the optimistic approach, where you kind of start up with the idea of, well, everything will be all right. We're just gonna let the threads run, and you only as soon as the conflict has then actually occurred, we will detect that and try to do some way of a resolution. So in case that we had a conflict already, we have some kind of invalid access anyway, so the common thing to do there would be probably to just abort at least one of the transactions. And with that, you open up another barrel where you find inside that if you abort such a transaction, that will, well, might be restarted immediately from the surrounding algorithm, and that might then just go through the same path and somehow create a conflict again, and well, in that case, you might end up with aborting either that or the other one, and that might add up to a system which is constantly just aborting and restarting, coming to a life lock. And yeah, you have to deal with something like that. Another aspect which you can observe in transactional memory implementations is the version management. You can do that in an eager or lazy fashion. That determines how to read and write the data during the transaction. Let's have a look at what the eager version management is actually about. Well, in such a case, you would just push your modifications that happened during the transaction directly already on the hardware, on the memory. And well, as there might still happen something like an abort during your execution, or there might be a conflict, you still need to somehow be able to restore the original state of the point of the program where you have started with your transaction. For that, so if you already apply all your changes to the memory, you somehow need to revert these changes. And for these purposes, you would keep something like an undo lock in that case. The other way to do version management would be the lazy one, where you just don't bother with communicating your changes that you do on the memory up till the very last chance of that, which means that you have to act, maybe at the commit, for example, where you would then only try to establish your changes on everything. And for that purpose, you would just leave the main memory alone and keep a redo log. And in case that you abort, well, you don't have to do anything. You just throw away the redo log, and everything's still in the state that was when you started your transaction. And only in case that you come to a point where you can actually commit, you would have to apply the changes that reside in the redo log to the actual common memory. So, design choices for optimistic concurrency control transactional memory, what do you have there? Well, you have certain points like the granularity of conflict detection, that also varies throughout the implementations. These might happen at cache line level or memory object levels. There's transactional memory systems where you kind of have object trees in the memory, and everything that is kind of encapsulated in one object and or its children can be within the granularity of your conflict detections. There might also be possibilities of false conflicts. For example, if you are managing on the cache line level and your accesses have not been on exactly the same memory slot, but they happen to reside in the same cache line, you might have these false conflicts. Then you have choices in the conflict detection, where you can act either, well, what can you do? You can act in an eager fashion and try to detect or assume that there is a conflict as soon as the very first memory access that has had a conflict is actually accessed, which would be the first thing that you could do in any way. Then you could go on a validating approach, where you would not just try to detect your conflicts as soon as they start, but you might give the system a little bit more time and only check at certain checkpoints, for example, whether you have run into a conflict, which would, well, maybe just save a little bit of time that would be needed in order to check for the actual conflicts. And then there's the quite extreme idea of that, well, you just don't bother about the conflicts actually happening, apart from, well, in the end, before you actually commit your thing, before you throw away your undo log or you pipe your redo log into the memory, at least at that point, you should in the end, or well, have to in the end, try to detect whether there had been a conflict. And that would be the lazy approach for that. The next design choice would be the reference of conflict for the, in that case, the non-ego conflict detection, where you have the tentative version of referring to a conflict, where you would assume that your thread A would somehow work with a memory cell that may be written at some time with thread B, which would be, well, it's not sure that that will actually in the end lead to a real conflict, but you would assume that to be a conflict anyway. So that would be the tentative version. And then there's the one way where you check in a where you refer to conflicts in a committed way in the sense that you detect the conflicts only against the threads that have actually in the end committed, so you know for sure that these conflicts have already occurred. So yeah, that's also variations in transactional memory. Yeah, so the general goal of transactions would be to specify atomic executions of sequences of programs, and yeah, for that you can have this ACID properties, which you should know from the databases lectures. Of course, everyone here has had databases, so all you know, all of you already know what that means. So can we puzzle that together? What's A? Atomic. Then C? Consistency, okay. I? Yeah. Isolation. And D? No D? It's quite amazing that's the last one that needs so much thinking. Because for that one, we can luckily just reveal everything. Durability. So these are our four properties there. Atomicity is, well, that the transaction has only two effects that are discernible from the outside in the sense of from other threads. You can, this transaction either seems to not have happened, or at one point of time it seems to have happened all in one. So these are the only things that you can observe from the outside. So that's for the atomicity. Then yeah, we have consistency. For consistency, well, the assumption for transactions would be that if you have implemented them in the way that they're meant to be, they start from a consistent state, and they when they have happened, because we can't observe something like a transaction is happening at the moment from the outside, and when they have executed and committed, they once again yield a consistent state. So the whole system always looks looks like a consistent system to the outside observer. So that would be the idea. Then there's the concept of isolation, in the sense that transactions have no way of interfering with each other. So during the execution of one of those, you don't have an influence on what's happening to the other, which is a little bit of a more complicated property in transactional memory area, because there's still the aspect of code that's not actually executed in a transactional memory way, and the question is how to deal with these parts of code living besides the transactional ones. And in the end, there's the durability one, and for our purposes, we would consider our changes to the memory to be permanent anyway. So yeah, that's not so much of an issue for the transactional memory people there. Okay, so apart from that, for the transactions themselves, there's still a few things to keep in mind. For example, they, with respect to each other, should be somehow serializable, so that there can be orderings on them. Because the semantics of the whole system of transactions is meant to be the result of one of that particular orderings or serializations of those transactions, and either of the ways that those transactions turn out to be serialized would be a valid outcome of the system. And so the general idea would be that serializability, since there's variation in that, you should not expect to be able to somehow synchronize between threads with the means of transactional memory things. So far, the aspects of the traditional transactions from databases. For transactional memory, there's actually another point, which would be an aspect when implementing the whole thing, which would be the consistency during the transactions. And what's that about? Well, the ACID properties state only assumptions about when the transactions have actually finished and committed, and all the others are considered not to be active, because you cannot observe them from the outside. However, for execution with transactional memory, you might end up in being interested in more details in there. You have variations in how your transactional memory is thought to be realized. For example, there might be transactional memory systems where a transaction can run on a system state which is produced or which already reflects a few of the changes that one of these eagerly version managed other transactions has already created. In such systems, you would actually be able to see inconsistent states within such a transactions, because it would be completely legal to have these eager changes already done to your memory, which would somehow break your invariance that you assume to be intact on these things. However, since at some point the transactional memory system would decide that when something like this has happened, that a conflict is there, and in the end would abort your your transaction, and that would be completely legal. However, you might see during the execution of that transaction on the on this inappropriate state, you might see things that you wouldn't have expected. So, yeah, there can be things like you see here, where you have an example with transactions there, and yeah, you would, for example, start to execute your system in parallel, which would mean that you can intersect the instructions there. And if you have such an eager system, which just rolls out all the changes and keeps an undo log and does conflict detection only at the very end of the transaction, you'll be able to actually see, for example, the first instruction happening and then have the second one, the second transaction then read both of the variables and only then continue with this one here on your memory, and with that you would be able to create a state where this X and Y, if they had been the same before, you would still come up with a realization that in there your invariant that both of the variables have been the same was actually broken. In such a case, in the end, the whole thing would have been cancelled anyway and aborted by the transaction memory when it checks whether there had been a conflict happening. But all the while, during your execution of the left thread, you might still see some strange things going on. So it actually makes sense to think about whether something like that is allowed to happen or not, because, well, you see later on that the implementations of transactional memory are not always perfect in the sense that they can actually always detect conflicts right when they're actually happening, and thus you might see something like that. And if your program then runs into strange error situations and exits with a core dump because you have unforeseen null pointers or anything like that, then yeah, it's not good, of course. So that's critical for systems where you have pointers, for example. And in order to talk about that, we introduce the concept of opacity, which would also be another property of such systems. And that is explicitly a property that talks about not only the transactions that in the end commit and are actually intact, but also about the failing transactions, in the sense that a system that has opacity as a feature, in that also the failing transactions are serializable with the committing transactions, which means that they are that also the failing transactions only are able to see valid states. So yeah, they have a consistent view on the memory. So with these aspects in mind, maybe a little bit on the aspect of isolation in context of transactional memory. We have already seen indicated as one of the things that might yield problems for transactional memory and the ACID properties was that you have the situations of not everything is a transaction, but there's also code out there which is just not marked as transaction, and it might still be legal for those parts of the program to still access the same parts of memory as the ones that are surrounded with transaction markers. So Yeah, the question is now whether your implementation ensures what kind of isolation your system is actually providing, whether it provides something like strong isolation, where also the parts which are not happening inside transactions are isolated from the transactions, or weak isolation, where those accesses can just interfere with your transactions, which is also a property of some of the transaction memory systems out there. So what happens if we mix code accessing memory transactionally and non-transactionally is, well, the thing is that you might imagine that for non-transactional accesses there actually is no such thing as conflict detection. So you end up with exactly the problems that you tried to circumvent by introducing the atomic or the transaction null blocks before. You would have race problems between the unprotected non-transactional blocks and the ones that are transactional. So the other way of realizing that would be the strong isolation part, where you have the thing that the transactional memory and the non-transactional memory actually have an order between each other and can't be accessed at the same time, which would lead to something like the single lock atomicity, where you have where the model says that when your program executes, it would execute as if all the transactions acquire a single program-wide mutual exclusion lock, such that you could imagine that you would have the complete attention of the system and nobody else to interfere with you. So that is a concept that talks about something like which programs would actually be meant which runs are actually meant when you define your program, and it's a concept of consistency of your system. And with single lock atomicity, you would would enforce orders between the transactional memory and non-transactional memory accesses, which would guarantee strong isolation between transactional memory and non-transactional memories. And within one transaction, you don't say anything about that. There, you might have reordering and what else you can imagine, as long as you keep the to some other standard, you can do in there what you want. But in between the parts of the transaction memory and the non-transactional memory, you guarantee that there's an order between those things. With that, you also buy into the property that the non-transactional memory actually is able to somehow receive information about other transactional blocks, actually, because you can have certain effects like the ones that you see over here, where the single lock atomicity model actually introduces some properties that you would have expected for transactional memory not to be true. For example, the one here, where you have single lock atomicity and two threads, like the one over here, thread one, which would start a transaction and in the transaction actually touch nothing at all, but just remain in that transaction forever. And you would have a second thread, which would also start a transaction, which would just innocently try to read from a memory area and then and then terminate. And in such a system where you would have to act as with just one single global lock at all, well, you would end up with taking the lock for thread one and looping indefinitely, such that thread two, although it does not conflict in any way with thread one's data accesses, would have to wait for the infinite loop. So you wouldn't have any progress for that one either. And that is pretty strong effect that the single lock atomicity has there on your progress guarantee of your program. The other thing that we have indicated, or we had indicated on the last slide, was the isolation in terms of being able to observe things about other transactions having already committed or not. And you could, with single lock atomicity, for example, actually synchronize your threads with each other, although that is something that we said would not be the actual purpose for the transactional memory. So let's have a look at these threads here. There's thread one, which would write to a data field and a ready field. It's pretty similar to the communication problem that we have seen a long while ago, where we introduced the memory barriers. And then there's the second thread, where we would try to read from the data and interpret that value in case that thread one signals with its ready flag that the data is actually somehow valid or ready to use or whatever. And for our purposes here, we can now, although the instructions that set data in thread one are outside of any synchronization means, only have their global lock in possession over here, they would now somehow be able to synchronize with thread two, because they, in that model, have the same global lock that they need in order to execute. So you know that for thread two, in the execution between the readout of the data and the read of the ready flag, you're pretty sure that thread one cannot advance from data to ready in any way, because for that that one would actually need to get in possession of the lock. Therefore, you can know that for that if you then read out the ready flag, execution must have actually passed the atomic from thread one definitely, and only then it's able to set the ready to true, and only then we can go in there. So only if it has passed and written to both of its fields, you will actually come to a situation where the ready flags that everything is okay and you can use and interpret the thing. So that is something like the barrier that we have seen in the first few things, and thus is communication between the threads, although they should in principle act as completely isolated, especially as the atomics don't have any overlapping data items in there. And yeah, that comes because you have that one single global lock between them. And yeah, since that is something that is stronger than we actually wanted to have, because we wanted to have more parallel executions possible in any way, we have a different model from that, which is the transactional sequential consistency model, in which the accesses within the transactions are just assumed to be sequentially consistent and nothing else for that. And this is a little bit weaker. It gives you strong isolation but allows for parallel executions of transactional blocks. However, that also means that you within the atomic blocks, you by yourself that you can't reorder your accesses anymore. So, yeah, there's a that's another difference to the single log atomicity. So, that is the model that actual implementations of transactional memory actually are using, together with a few other properties, but in principle, the transactional sequential consistency is the model that you can assume for transactional memory to be valid. The way that such blocks could actually be realized would be, at first it started as an implementation as kind of a library where you would have to explicitly call certain library methods in order to start a transaction, to commit a transaction, to read from data and to write to data. And with that you could, for example, translate something like our beloved atomic blocks to an instrumented version of the code that you had before with exactly those things, where you would have to, if you encounter such an atomic block, you would have to start a do-while loop, which would try to execute your transaction until it at some point actually succeeded. And in that loop, you would always try to actually start the transaction anew, or for the first time, in case that you enter the thing for the first time, and then perform the actual code that you find in there, over here, but just with a few annotations being added to the code, in case that you encounter something like read accesses to variables. For those, you would introduce a call to the library function read transactionally, and you would also pay attention to all the writes to variables, for which you would also refer to the version from the library and have the write transactionally there. And in the end, issue the commit to the library, and in case that succeeds, that will lead to true, and you can exit the loop. In case that it has not been able to commit, you will have to go back your loop and just start anew. So that would be the first version of how to do that. That can be achieved with a preprocessor, so you don't need to do that manually. And with that, you would try to implement that in a library in some meaningful way, and you could translate just the variables as being managed by your transactional memory. And of course, that is just a very rough way of translating it, because you would assume just every one of the accesses to variables within your atomic block to be accesses to shared variables. Of course, if you would do that in a manual way, you would just just use these read and write transaction library calls for variables which would actually be visible to other transactions, and only keep them or only keep managing them with the library functions. But yeah, as you have to come up with something automatic, you might, at least in the first version, not try to put too much complications in there, and doesn't hurt to treat variables as being possibly accessed from outside. Of course, if you do that manually, you would have more fine-grained control on which of these variables you would have to use these things. Another thing that is found in common implementations is the ways to actually trigger the failure of the transaction because of some internal reason. Maybe you have transactional memories that have the possibility to run on memory that is inconsistent. In such cases, you would like to roll back, and for that you would have something like a retry. Well, in this case it says keyword, which would then refer to that side, of course, but that could also be offered with API calls to the implementation. And that would just abort the transaction and restart. And yeah, you can now imagine that for such a thing to be meaningful, it would, if everything is just this, the same way as it had been before, then it will of course once again run into the same retry statement. So the retry statement only makes sense to be used in situations where you actually expect that you have a chance of succeeding the next time that you try. So you think that would think for that the reset that you're, or the variables that you read up to, until that point of retry would actually have a chance to change at some point. Yeah. Okay, so with that, we can have a look at how implementations of transactional memory are actually looking like, and there are several ways of achieving transactional memory semantics. There's, of course, the version of the variant of software transactional memory, where you could use just any old non-transactional system and rely on the software implementation to provide the desired features. And you could, for example, realize that by establishing a transaction descriptor that has all the management utils that you need during a transaction. You would create that at the start of an atomic block, and you could keep in there, for example, the undo log or the redo log and all these means of actually versioning your changes. You could keep read and write sets in order to decide whether there's conflicts working. You might also keep something like read or write versions, which could also use in order to detect whether there's conflict actually happening or not. And there's several implementations out there. Many of them are somehow stalled in their development, but there's one which is actually still both accessible and readable from the outside, which is this TL2 system. And that is one particular implementation that's quite easy to use and easy to understand, at least with respect to what software transactional memory implementations have as complexity. So the properties of that system is, for example, that it provides opacity in the sense that even transactions that are going to fail at some point won't be able to observe an inconsistent state. So the changes to your system are just private up until the point where you do commit. It uses lazy versioning with a redo log. Well, that probably is coming coupled with the opacity thing. The redo log just has all your local changes, and only in the end that is given to the globally considered valid memory. Then the other thing is that it has a kind of a validating conflict detection concept, in the sense that accessing a modified address aborts your transaction. Yeah. What else is there? The TL2 system manages a global version counter, which is just well one numeric value that is counted up each time that a transaction is started. You would have a read version, in the sense that of version being an evaluation of the global count, and you would have such a read version in each of the objects that your transactional memory is actually managing, which would need for the malloc to allocate a few more bytes for each of the allocated memory versions. Then there's a redo log in the transaction descriptor, which achieves this lazy versioning slash opacity property, and a read and write set in the transaction descriptor in order to validate the conflict detection, to perform conflict detection. Okay, so let's have a look at how a transactional read could actually be implemented. So the idea would be to have this read in a transactional way within object OBG at offset. So for that you would need the reference to the transactional memory descriptor that you created with your start transaction, which is this TX, and of course the object that you want to access, and the offset at which you want to access that object. And yeah, in case of the implementation of TL2, you would then, first of all, well, you store all your accesses to memory where you have written anything or modified anything in the redo log. So first of all, you would consider whether the data that you're looking for is actually in the redo log, and in that case you would give the modified version of that thing as return to you of your read of the transaction. And that is the easy part. There, all the versioning has already happened before, because for that, well, you have the timestamp of your transaction as the logical clock evaluation. In case that you haven't yet written to your memory, you have to obtain this memory part from the common global memory of all the processes, and for that you would somehow have to make sure that you don't interact in a bad way with other transactions. So for that, what you would do is you would try to obtain the timestamp of the object that you try to access, and at the same point, at the same time, try to see whether there's the mutex for that object taken by someone else. Mutex, you say? For the implementation of TL2, you would keep for every object which is managed by transactional memory, would keep a semaphore or a mutex that can or needs to be taken in case that someone wants to write to that particular part of the thing, because, well, you don't have any hardware support. You have to somehow in the end make sure that a few things happen in an atomic way. So we will see later on what is done at the point of commit. So and that's where these logs actually are grabbed. And in case that the log is in possession of someone else, this is a strong indicator that someone else is at the moment writing or intending to write in that memory thing. So we read something that another transaction wants to write, and that's a bad thing for our state, and we don't want to see something like that. So we need to have a look at that. So in case that the access was not locked, we have obtained the version of our timestamp, then what we do is we then just read from the object the offset that we're interested in, and then obtain a second version, another timestamp. And now we need to evaluate whether we are likely to run into an inconsistent state, or where we have observed an inconsistent state, and that might be either if a commit is actually at the moment intending to write something, or whether the version has already changed in the short time between taking the first timestamp, reading from the memory, and taking the second timestamp. And also, if someone else has marked the object with a timestamp that is actually in the future of the timestamp that our transaction actually started, then some kind of change may already have happened before I even tried to read from that memory area. And all these three conditions are ones that we are actually not desiring. So in these cases, we will then just abort the transaction. And if not, then everything went fine, and we can just add the object as being part of our read set and return the result. So there's quite a lot to do for the read transactional implementation. You might wonder what else is there to do for the write. Well, that's much simpler, because you just have to update the location into the redo log, so we don't have a look at that. Instead, we'll have a look at what is happening when we do actually propagate the change from the redo into the memory, which will then be this commit transaction thing. And that is, once again, working with a reference to the transaction descriptor. And apart from that, it doesn't need anything else, because it already carries everything it needs. For example, it first of all has internally a reference to all the objects that had been touched in a write. And for that, the commit needs to obtain the log, the mutex. And that is something that's done with this try wait. That's a special implementation of wait, which will not actually go to busy wait on the log, but the try wait will, in the case that it cannot obtain the log, just return that it's not possible to go in there. In that case, it will just fail, and with that, the commit will have to abort. Then, in case that we have in case we haven't gone to fail yet, we will have obtained all the logs on the write set of my transaction, which means that I'm now in the situation where I actually can perform my write update. Thus, what I will do is I will I will perform. Okay, I think for this one here, I'm actually missing the amount that I add to my global clock. Yeah, the concept would be to increase the global clock by some value. In our case, well, one would suffice, but I have to mention what I add to that, and otherwise it doesn't make sense. But in any way, with that, I would get my own write version, WV, and that would be the write version to store in each of the objects that I intend to write to. Then I check whether the reads that I have performed during my transactions are still the same that they have been when I started my transaction with the next thing. So that's that part. If those are also still the same, that I then I have my invariant intact and I can have my state that I observed of the machine being the same as it has been in the beginning, and with that I can then start to flush my redo log into the memory by just going through the redo log, and in the end set my increased version of the global clock as the new version of each of these objects, and make way for other transactions to access the objects once again. And in that case, we have a successful commit and can return. And what I do with fail is that I would have to also release all the semaphores that I have in possession, and then just communicate to the surrounding program that the commit was not successful. Thus, I'm doing return false. So that's how the TL2 system actually works. Since it has this redo log, it guarantees the opacity. And thus, during the execution of any of these transactions, even the ones that fail, they only see a consistent state, and only at the point where we try to actually commit in the end, we will realize that there is a conflict or that a conflict has happened, and we realize that there's an inconsistent state, and we will have to, well, just not perform the changes that we have assumed to be valid there. Yeah. With that, I would like to continue on a little bit with, well, maybe let's have a look at at that one. You buy into a few, maybe a little bit strange behaviors with that implementation. For example, if the granularity of your synchronized blocks or of your transactional blocks, is too large, you might see behavior like the one over here, where you have your transactional block like this. The effect of that would be that as soon as you enter your transaction, you get your personal copy of the most recent or of the actual evaluation of the global clock, and you would store it in your transactional descriptor and keep that as your reference point of the memory all in all. And you would assume that to be the state that you want to refer to. And in case that you have reads from the global memory states after you have already done a lot of work you still have to check whether the version that you read is the one that you have taken from above. Even if you, in cases where you haven't actually accessed anything else from the global memory, you would still use the clock that you have obtained at the beginning of your transactional part as the reference point. Thus, even though you only read at that point and only at that point are dependent on whether the invariant is intact or not, you still have a quite large area in which you require the value of the shared variables to remain the way that they have been. And with that you might have to compete with transactions that are, for example, like this, quite short, and they might be the way that those interfere with your transaction, in the sense that they are just quicker to terminate and modify the respective variable. And although the actual instructions which access these things are quite the same length, and you would expect the whole system to just work quite fine, as you have the whole span of thread one as the area in which the value must remain intact, you will end up with restart of your transaction, for example. And with that you can get into situations where the transaction on the left just starves. Also, the other thing is that with the implementation like that, you have seen that there's locks involved. So there are these mutexes for each of the memory objects that are somehow touched during the transactions. And for each of them, you need your own lock. So as soon as you start committing, you'll get a lot of locks being taken and released once again, which is, of course, not a cheap thing to do. So with you can imagine that if you have a lot of transactions, you run into a lot of traffic just related to doing lock management, and a lot of them might just stall the other for a short time, and that of course causes a lot of contention on these things. So you could try to organize the cells that are actually touched within certain transactions so that they end up residing in the same memory objects, so that you need just only a few locks, but that once again needs a lot of intelligence and complicated algorithms, and you might just not want to invest that much of effort for that. Good. This life log thing, I think we have seen in the example already. So, what's still open there is how you would handle resources that don't fit the restrictions that are imposed on you with these library calls. We have seen this implementation only work for plain memory cells if we have something like I/O involved, or just memory mapped sensors, or anything, things that are volatile and might change randomly. Well, those don't exactly fit into the concept of transactions in there, and you might wonder what you would like to do with these things. So there are several choices for that. You might either try to prohibit that, just using sensor data in order to perform a transaction is, well, pretty much questionable, I would say, because that's just depending on outside values, and as soon as you try to restart your transaction, it might just be completely different from before. And yeah, it's just I'm not even sure what a transaction on sensor data actually means. So yeah, that's something that you could make your compiler just reject, for example. The next possibility would be to, well, just don't care and just execute whatever you find in there. Well, if it just doesn't fit the concept of transactions anyway, then yeah, don't care. And if then there's things that you can't really take back again, well, you could just abort everything. And yeah, that's of course one valid way to do that. Then the other way would be to just say, well, there's non-transactional parts involved in there. And as soon as I start realizing that I cannot revert the changes that I do, then just give that particular transaction priority and just perform until we reach the end of the transaction in order to then revert anything else and only then restart everything, all the other transactions that might have had conflicts with ours, in the hope that I can just finish doing my I/O and then everything can be transactional once again. So that's also one concept. And the last thing would be to just, well, rewrite everything. Well, we had green already, hadn't we? So just rewrite all the code to be transactional, which is, of course, well, yeah, there are a few things that turn out to be quite difficult to rewrite, like error logging or writing out data to a file or something. And yeah, it's not always always possible, but what can you do? So the other alternative of having transactional memory would be the hardware supported version. So hardware transactional memory it is. Turns out that that has been a hot topic in hardware research for a long time, and although for a long time we only had software implementations, we now finally have, even in mainstream processes, a means of having support for at least a limited size of code transactions. So for that, there was necessary a few changes in the architectures of the processors. There was additional hardware for tracking read and write sets, and the general idea of how to achieve something like transactional memory was to make use of the cache. Thus, we will have a look at how cache works with the addition of hardware transactional memory once again later on a little bit. And yeah, so if you can reuse the facilities that the cache provides, we can make it quite cheap to perform at least a certain variant of conflict detection on there. So what we would do is we would keep cache lines as being marked as read and write sets of transactions, and if someone else, for example, invalidates a cache line that is marked as being in a read set of a transaction, we would let the transaction abort. Same as if we realize that a cache line of a write set must be written back, then well, someone else has issued a read request on something that is in the write set of our transaction. So in that case, also our transaction needs to abort. The only drawback that we have is that the way that we can specify our transactions means that we are actually limited a little bit by hardware, because these hardware resources can only be finite in a certain sense. So the way to go for hardware transactional memory is to offer also a software backup solution in case that the hardware one is just too limited to realize the actual needs for our transactions. So there's two principles, ideas of realizing hardware transactional memory. There's the one which is quite close to the software transactional memory solution, where you would have similar to the instructions that we've seen with start and read and write and commit. We would introduce such micro instructions to our instruction set and perform a translation of our source code into completely different to the way that we have translated before. And yeah, that is something which would, of course, work. However, that would mean that I would have to provide separate binaries for, or at least library versions for systems that support transactional memory and systems that, that do not support this thing, and that might be a little bit problematic. And the other way of realizing that would be the implicit implementation, where the only things that you would mark would be the beginning and the end of a transaction. And for everything that happens within the transaction, you would just you be able to just use the same instructions that you have used before. Just the hardware would then interpret the instructions as being transactional instructions. And yeah, so as soon as in such a realization, you would perform some kind of more different hardware accesses or anything system related, you would just abort the transaction. And yeah, with that, you could realize systems where you would only, well, if you designed in the right way, you could make it in a way that non-transactional systems are not interfered with these instructions and can still execute kind of similar way the code. But we'll see something like that when we go to hardware lock elision. But anyway, examples for hardware transactional memory concepts out there was, well, that's pretty dead, I would say, is the approach over here, where we had actual explicit version of hardware transactional memory, but it just I haven't seen any processor that really is able to do that, and I think it's also didn't make its way to actual compilers, so let's not waste too much time about that, apart from realizing that that was actually an implementation where you would have explicit data transfer between normal memory and transactional memory. And apart from that, it didn't make it to concrete products anyway, so let's not talk too much about that. The other one that actually made it to real hardware is the transactional memory extensions, in this case, in the Intel Notion. And yeah, since August 2014, we actually have seen processors that have that features announced, and 2015, we've had the first high-end processor, i7s, I think, delivered with that. And meanwhile, I think it also, well, it also made its way into the more common lines of processors. So I don't know whether you have it on your laptop or not, but at least for tutorial, I have a laptop where we can just try these things out. So we'll see about that. This is a design choice for that that is implicitly transactional, in the sense that you can just use the normal instructions within your transactions, and you only have to announce that you start and you commit your transaction. And it tracks read and write sets using a bit in the cache lines. So yeah, it's not too much more, but each of the cache lines has one bit that signifies that that cache line is part of a transaction, so it kind of merges read and write sets. Since the system has to make sure that the CPU is able to roll back at a certain point. What we also have is a backup space for the CPU registers. There's a counter which tells us about how deeply we are nested within our transactions in order to somehow know when we can commit our things. Yeah, the only thing is that as soon as we run out with cache lines and or other resources, the whole transaction may abort in certain situations. And the other thing is that as soon as we abort any of the nested transactions, we actually abort all of them. And there's two flavors of how to work with that. There's the restricted transaction memory extensions, which are kind of or give means for implementing the atomic sections that we have seen so far. And there's also the other notion of hardware lock elision, which is a way to kind of bring the benefits of hardware transactional memory to systems that have had conventional locks, and we'll see both of them. So let's first of all start with restricted transactional memory, because we want to have our atomic blocks finally. And well, I've said that there's certain things added to the instruction set, which is the xbegin instruction on the assembly, and then there's the xend, which is the commit, and those two are the ones that are added in hardware, as well as xabort in order to, do the retry keyword, and then there's the xtest to actually check whether the processor is executing transactionally. So with that being embedded as API functions in C, you could, for example, realize something like transactional memory in a way like this one over here. This is an example that we will use to illustrate the different ways of how to actually deal with transactional memory in the Intel Notion. And you'll see that the xbegin is the thing that you use to start your transactional memory there. And if it yields minus one, well, actually in the API you would have a constant there that tells you that a successfully created a transactional memory region. If that is the case, then you would here enter the transaction body and be able to perform your update on memory. So you could use your traditional memory access instructions there and just don't care. The system would take care of that. And in the end, when you finished, you would issue your commit with the xend thing. Yeah, then there's, of course, the question, why do I need this if around? Well, the case is that if during the execution of the transaction something happens, and that will leads to aborting your transaction, then control would conceptually go over from wherever the transaction has aborted back to over here. Just with one difference, xbegin would now not yield the same constant successfully established transaction or minus one anymore, but something different. And you have the chance to react to that in the else branch. And since we have the properties that in the hardware transactional memory, we cannot deal with arbitrary transactions, but only with limited resources, we have to make sure that we actually provide an appropriate reaction to whenever a transaction fails, because that might fail because of limited resources, and in that case, we won't ever have a chance to get our complete transaction executed, because, well, we might just have run out of cache lines, and if we have used the maximum number of cache lines at all, then well, we just never will be able to execute that, and for that we will need to have fallback. Yeah, and that needs to be, well, kind of user user provided, but well, we'll see that there's implementations what you they can use instead. Particularly the software transactional memory can be used then, but yeah. Anyway, one possible idea of having a fallback path would be if to do something ourselves. But well, of course, we can't just put the same code that we have had before in there, because in that case we would create such a situation where we have non-transactional code, and if there are several of threads executing that, we might run into problems with that. So that's not a solution for that. Instead, what have we seen for common mutex techniques? Well, just apply a lock in there. So we could do something like that. With that, we would have the fallback part path. If both of the threads end up in their fallback path, then, well, we will have it lock protected. Very nice. But in that case, if one of the threads is in the locked part and one of the threads in the transactional part, we still have the situation that there might be interactions between those two, which just violate our isolation. So still not done yet. We have to make sure that this block and this block don't interfere with each other. And yeah, there's just the kind of dirty trick in there. We can just do something like try to read from the counter of the mutex. If we do that, we will get the mutex into the read set of the transaction. And in there, remember, whenever we do such a wait, we will write to the mutex's counter. And if we do so, and the transaction has the mutex in its read set, then that will roll back the translation. So with that, we have established a way of communicating between the part where we have non-transactional access and transactional access. By just, I should maybe remove that in order to make the bang visible. We have established communication between those parts in the sense that they would mutually exclude each other, particularly in the sense that the non-transactional memory would cancel any other transaction that that refers to the same mutex protected thing. Apart from that, if there's no transaction in the fallback path, then a read just won't hurt anything, and the mutex will be larger than zero in that case, and we won't have an X abort, but instead perform our transaction ordinarily. So that would be the way to implement the fallback, for example. What is the actual effect of having restricted transactional memory in the Intel setup? Well, we now have an additional register bank for backup of the processor internal registers and a counter for nested transactions. And what we have is the xbegin instruction. What that does is it will back up the registers and, at least if we are in a non-transactional environment so far, and increment the counter for nested transactions. Then, in case that any access to cache line happens, then if the cache line is present, we would just put the new flag T on there. If it's not present, we would just request that from memory or other caches, and also set the transaction flag. Then, if we get an invalidate message from any other from our the invalidation queue to a cache line that is part of the transaction, then someone else tries to write to the to a line which is part of the transaction. Thus, we will have an X abort. If we observe a read message for a modified cache line, which is also part of the transaction, we will also do an abort. And what the abort will actually do is the abort will go through all the lines that have the transactional flag and set them to invalid. Also reset the counter of nested transactions and restores the CPU register. And finally, if we reach an X commit, we will just decrement the Z. And in case that we have reached the level zero, we will be able to just clear away all the transaction flag and assume that our cache state is now valid, and thus have committed our transactions. So that is how RTM is working. But as people are already flooding in the room, I think we will have to continue with the end of transactional memory next time. So we'll have a look at how that works on the level of cache lines. And yeah, with that, I wish you a nice few days until we have a tutorial. So thank you for your attention and goodbye.